Hello and welcome to another edition of the Harrogate Podcast with me, Andrew Gray. Today I welcome back Guy Phoenix. Guy was on a previous podcast in which we discussed cybercrime and so on. But today we're going to talk about Guy Phoenix, the business person. Now, when I met Guy for the first time back in March, I really was blown away by his background. It was most unusual, fascinating, and I came away with sort of 4 or 5 pages of notes of things I wanted to ask him about, hence we arranged another podcast today. But when thinking how I can describe Guy, and he's sort of sniggering at me, just trying to work out how to describe him, I would describe him as international man of mystery, although he doesn't like that. I'd describe him as a workaholic, although I don't think he likes that either. And I'd also describe him as a playaholic, which I know he really doesn't like. But he's a business person. He's sort of local and yet international. He's worked for mega organisations like Rolls-Royce, but he's also owned smaller IT companies. And he's told me recently that he's bought a new IT company in Leeds. Congratulations. But Guy, I've done my best to describe you, but I don't think I've done it justice. How would you describe you to my listeners?
Thanks very much for that, Andrew, and it's a pleasure to be here again, and thank you for inviting me back. I really don't know how to answer that question, quite honestly. I'm just like anybody else is trying to make their way through life and find their way through life. I'm not even sure now if I'm doing it right half a century in, quite frankly.
But it seems like it's going pretty well to me. And you're being humble as well, unless I missed something out, but you've written the book entitled Two Funerals about your experience in Hurricane Irma in the British Virgin Islands, and you're in the middle of writing a book with the working title of Get Up as well. So you're an author as well as the international man of mystery. Is that fair to describe you as an author?
I'm not at all sure it is. We'll see about that. I think it's for others to judge. Hurricane Irma and my book Two Funerals, although it's published, I didn't make it available for sale because it was such a intense personal experience that I've only given the book to close personal friends to convey to them what it was like, because it's actually practically impossible to put it into words. So that was really my first foray into writing. They've all told me they like it, but then they would because they're friends and family. So I thought, because the book fell out of me, it encouraged me to think, well, I'll write a proper book. And I've decided I will write it on my experience of the past 10 years of moving to the British Virgin Islands and everything that's gone on and happened since then. And the working title, as you say, is Get Up, because there have been several challenges on numerous occasions where I have frankly felt poleaxed, and the next day you get up.
Perfect. Well, let's get to the beginning of Guy Phoenix. Born in Worcestershire, I think, but then moved over to Dubai as a 7-year-old. Tell us about your early years of your life.
Sure. I was born in Kidderminster in West Midlands, Worcestershire. My mum and dad's house was in Bewdley, so I was brought up in Bewdley as a child, went to infant school there and also the junior school.
All pretty normal stuff so far.
Yeah, absolutely normal. Although in those days I was allowed to walk to school on my own. Nice times, good times. Then it was during the 70s and the economic times were tough in the UK. There was a construction boom going on in the Middle East. My dad was in the construction industry and he took the decision to take himself, my mum and me and our dog out to Dubai, which is, for those of you listening, your listeners who've been to Dubai recently, is unrecognisable from the Dubai that I was brought up in, which was basically a sandpit.
Until your dad helped to construct many of those tower blocks.
One of many expatriates who was in charge of building buildings.
And so therefore you were schooled in, I imagine, an international school.
That's correct, yeah. So I went to the newly opened Jumeirah English Speaking School as my first school there. And then after a couple of years, the reasons I can't remember why I moved, I think it might have just been because of the age group that Jess could deal with, I moved to a brand new school called Dubai College. Not so new now, of course, but I went to, as one of the first students at Dubai College.
And you weren't doing the GCSEs, O-levels route. So it was is it International Baccalaureate, I think you studied?
That's right. In later years, we actually moved to Abu Dhabi when I went to Shuafat International School, which is a Lebanese school. And that's where I took the International Baccalaureate.
and maybe explaining why I describe you as an international man of mystery, because it seems like your schooling has really had an impact upon, you know, where you've chosen to live and to work through your life. Would that be fair to say?
It absolutely would. I think when I got my first job after university, I set out my stall with all of my employers to say, I really want to work overseas. And so that was undoubtedly driven by the fact that I had lived overseas in the Middle East for nearly 9 years as a child.
And where was university?
I went to the University of Nottingham.
So, and what did you study?
I did a joint honours degree in electronic engineering and mathematics. And yeah, by the way, University of Nottingham, when you sell it as a 50-50 degree, yeah, no, it was more like 80-80. So I actually had to work at university, unlike most of my friends.
But it's worked out nicely for you. And dare I ask what grade that you got at Nottingham?
I achieved a first class honours degree.
Wow, there aren't many of those, and they certainly didn't hand them out in that many, you know, whatever years you went to university. So what year would you have graduated?
1989.
Well done, first class honours degree in two subjects, essentially. I'm not sure of anyone else on the Harrogate podcast who's in your intellectual capacity or qualifications. Perhaps I'm doing a disservice to those who've already been interviewed. But so from university, then, with this fantastic degree, what was your sort of first venture into the world of work?
I first joined a company in Nottingham, which was a joint venture between GEC and Plessey Telecommunications as a software engineer. I didn't enjoy the job, and so after a year, I applied for and got a job at Rolls-Royce PLC, then spent the next 10 years of my career.
Probably one of the coolest companies I would have thought you could work for. Now, my understanding is that there's sort of two sections to Rolls-Royce. There's the Rolls-Royce of the cars with the celebrities in them, sure, and so forth, but then there's also the more interesting bit of Rolls-Royce, which I think you worked in. What did your element or side of Rolls-Royce do?
Sure. Well, Rolls-Royce PLC is Rolls-Royce. Interesting fact. Well, interesting to me, but your listeners might think it's not that interesting. Rolls-Royce Motor Company is not part of Rolls-Royce PLC. And in fact, my understanding, and it might not be correct anymore, but certainly when I worked there, was that the Rolls-Royce Motor Company had to license the use of the Rolls-Royce logo off Rolls-Royce PLC. So the Rolls-Royce PLC that I worked for, most people will recognise them as from aircraft engines when you go on a plane and go on holiday and all of that. I didn't work in the aero division. I worked in the industrial sector and the nuclear sector, and latterly the marine sector.
So 10 years in Rolls-Royce, and I think you rose very quickly within that organisation, it's fair to say. Now, what sort of positions did you hold whilst you worked there?
I started out as a software engineer, very junior software engineer, and worked on some really exciting projects whilst doing that. I expressed an interest to broaden my career and moved into a commercial division. I was very fortunate in that role that my manager had previously been the area manager for a Rolls-Royce office in Tokyo, and having made it clear to him my aspiration to work overseas, he very kindly put me forward for that role, which I got.
So, how long are you in Japan for?
Just under 3 years, yeah, did that. And I would say that was probably a life-changing experience for me. It's one of those things that you look back on and say, yeah, when I went into that, I was a different person when I came out of it.
How so?
I would say that it gave me a business education. It gave me a Japanese business education, actually.
And is that a good business education to have, a Japanese one? Aren't some of the companies a bit slow to make decisions? Aren't they very male-orientated? Do the men, you know, get onto the Tokyo trains or whatever at 8 o'clock in the morning and get home at 8 o'clock at night, and, you know, very slow progression? It doesn't seem like the sort of Silicon Valley, fast-paced business world of other countries, maybe.
That's a very good point, and culturally, all of the things you just said are spot on. But in terms of understanding how business works and the kind of things you need to do to really make a business work, that's really what I'm alluding to in terms of it being a business education. And you're quite right, yeah, I've been pushed onto trains, jammed in like sardines. I was there pretty much every day. And yes, you do work late. And of course, being a representative of a predominantly UK business, which Rolls-Royce mostly was in those days, the time difference being 8 or 9 hours, depending on the time of year, would mean that by about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when one would hope you were winding down, the phone would start ringing from the UK and you could very easily do another half a day in the office.
I can understand why it sort of taught you business, but, you know, drilling into that, you know, what was it about the way the Japanese did it rather than the long hours which sort of forms Guy Fenix, the business person?
Relationships, for sure. Relationships, in one word. Their approach, I mean, their approach is clearly different to Western approach, but ultimately, everything they do is geared towards building relationships. And that's something you have to learn very quickly if you're working in Japan or indeed dealing with Japanese business people. You will have meetings with them all day long, and you might feel that you're not getting anywhere, as you alluded to earlier. It does seem to be quite ponderous and quite slow. And that's simply because of their whole approach of building up a consensus. No one likes to go too quickly in Japan. They all want to make sure they're going together as a team. So we may view it in Western eyes as it being too slow and bureaucratic, but what they're actually doing is making sure the team are together and going forward together with the approach. So there's that aspect of it. And then the other thing is that if you go out socially, well, it's not if you go out socially, when you go out socially, because it's essential to forming the relationships, you'll have a dinner and that will all be very convivial. And then typically you will then go to a karaoke bar. Anyone who's ever experienced karaoke in Japan will know that it's very different to our experience of karaoke in the West, where we have a bit of fun and we can be slightly embarrassed about it. It's quite the opposite. It's very serious, and no one will ridicule you for standing up and being dreadful, which I was.
And is there a particular dreadful moment of Fenix the singer in Japan that, you know, you really ought to tell us about? Any
particular song? This will be the first time.
I did it my way.
It's much, much worse. This will be the first time I've actually admitted this in public.
Do I need to turn the microphone off at this point?
We'll decide if it can go out afterwards. So I was in one particularly turgid session where, with the greatest respect to some of my Japanese colleagues, they will often choose to sing songs which are quite maudlin and kind of woe is me kind of songs. And I was getting a bit fed up with that. I said, we've got to liven this up. So I called the Mama San over. I said, have we got any Elvis or anything like that? And so she said, yeah, I don't know. So that's our great Hound Dog. Put that on, I'll do that. That'll be fine. So on comes Hound Dog. And they, oh yeah, Fenix San, off you go. So I go up. And they're all getting really excited about it. So I'm getting quite excited because they're getting excited. We're getting the whole place going. So when you kick into Elvis's chorus of, you ain't nothing but a hound dog, I decided I would jump up to do an Elvis turn, forgetting, of course, I'm 6 foot, whereas most Japanese are at least 6 inches shorter than me. The ceiling was very low, and I promptly knocked myself out.
And woke up in hospital, or what?
No, I woke up a couple of minutes later, and they'd got a glass of Suntory whiskey waiting for me, so all was good.
It sounds to me that is similar to the scenes in Lost in Translation with Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson, which I think is one of your favourite films.
It is. I think if pressed, and of course anything like that is emotive and it depends on your mood, but I'd probably say if someone asked me what's your favourite film ever, I'd say Lost in Translation.
And that's why we bonded when we last spoke, because that is also my favourite film, and you're the only other person I've met who said it's their favourite film. It doesn't even score very high on IMDb, I don't think, Lost in Translation, but what does everybody else know about the films? So after your stint in Japan, where to next? I mean, surely anywhere else is pretty boring in comparison to Japan.
Yeah, well, Rolls-Royce brought me back, much to my chagrin, that there had been a potential opportunity in the South Pacific, which was quite alluring, but they wanted me to come back and do a proper job, in their words. So that's when I joined the Marine Division and became a worldwide head of marine sales and contracts, which was probably the longest job I held and the last job I held before moving on.
Where is that based?
That was based at Anstey in Coventry, near Coventry.
So you were sent to Coventry very literally.
I was literally sent to Coventry, yes.
And at that stage, as sort of head of the marine division, you know, how far off were you from the board of Rolls-Royce?
Well, I wasn't head of marine because I had a boss who was. Martin Duckworth, who's sadly no longer with us, he reported to another gentleman who was on the main board. I was getting up there.
And you didn't fancy climbing the greasy pole? Because I know that the next bit in your story is you pivot into a completely different sector.
Yeah. Everyone likes the look of the next rung up the ladder, of course. But by that point, I'd reached the conclusion that I didn't want to be in one company all my life. I wanted to go and try something different. And it was about that time that the dot-com boom came along.
So early 90s then?
No, late 90s, yeah. And I decided, when I was at university, it was kind of like the whole boom of the Thatcher years and all of that. And the stock market had been quite alluring, particularly as someone who was taking maths. And I decided I'd be a good boy for mum and dad and complete my degree. And I didn't regret it, but I often look back and, you know, you wonder what if. And I always told myself, look, if ever something like that comes up again, just do it. And so the dot-com boom came along. So I got in touch with a dot-com company and I joined them.
Just like that. You just, emailed and said, well, if you could have emailed, I suppose you would have rang back in those days maybe and said, yeah. Hi, I'm the deputy head of sales of the Marine Division of Rolls-Royce. Can I have a job, or whatever the title was? That's how you got it.
I can't remember the exact mechanics, but it was pretty much like that. And I think, frankly, the dot-coms were all growing so rapidly, they would just grab anyone at those in those days. But it was fortunate I had a good CV behind me to come on in.
Sure. And, you know, what was this dot-com business doing?
They were effectively trying to buy and sell machinery online, any kind of equipment or machinery online.
So Amazon, essentially, for machines.
Yeah, which now, of course, just sounds like, well so what? But then, of course, this was cutting-edge stuff, and everyone was trying to carve out a niche, and that this whole new approach to markets was, like any new approach to markets, sorting itself out messily and with contradiction. But yeah, that's what those guys were doing.
And what was your role within the dot-com company?
To foster relationships with corporations who were offloading machinery and equipment, so we could set up a second-hand machinery hub online.
I know it didn't end well. Tell us why it ended more in tears than it did end in sort of pops of cash.
Well, it wasn't so much that it ended in tears, and I haven't looked for a while, but I'm pretty sure they're still a going concern, although in a very different kind of business model now. But to be perfectly candid about it, working at Rolls-Royce was great, but I didn't have a great amount of savings behind me as a result. As you know, you work in corporate life, and you know there are pros and cons. One of the cons is maybe it's not a great way of putting a lot of savings behind you. So the idea behind the dot-com was, of course, you got stock options, and there was one sunny morning where my stock options went to seven figures. But regrettably, you're tied in for a certain period before you can realise them. And in that interim period was when the dot-com crash came about.
What happened to you?
Nothing at all, but I quickly realised that I'm on an even lower salary here than I was at Rolls-Royce, which was a conscious decision because of the stock options. And now the stock options are not going to happen, so it's time to go back to reality.
Had you stayed, would you have realised those stock options?
No.
No chance?
No.
Even though they're still going today?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. Sorry to press you on that.
That's all right.
So after, what would that be, a year at a dot-com company?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, a year, 18 months, I can't remember. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Where to next in this fascinating journey?
I applied for a job at GEC Alstom, railway company, railway business in the UK, and they appointed me as their commercial director in the UK.
Because Japanese trains run on time, and therefore you can make the British trains run on time. Is that the logic?
I don't think that was necessarily the logic. But I think,
because you didn't make them run on time. So,
I think because They're not just a UK business. They're selling parts and trains and all of that internationally. There's always that international element, and I think they took the view that at that point in my career, I was someone who was capable of being parachuted. Pretty much, someone actually said this to me: "We can parachute you into a country, and we know you'll sort out whatever's going on, or you know, it won't be a sink or swim. You'll swim." So it was that kind of idea, I think.
So a lot of air miles during this period of time.
Yeah, and surprisingly rail miles as well. Not that such a thing exists. It's a pity it doesn't.
Doesn't, absolutely. So that I think brought you to Yorkshire, is that right? This time with the train companies?
That job didn't, but that was at the point I decided I would now strike out on my own. And so I looked for an acquisition, and I was able to achieve that in 2004, and that is when I did move to Yorkshire.
And what did you buy?
I bought a small diesel generator distributor.
As you do.
Yeah.
So Guy, you bought this company in 2004, this diesel generator, whatever it would be.
Distributor.
Yeah. Thank you for helping me out there. Now, how did you choose a business? Because I know you're in the rail world, yes, sure, and Rolls-Royce, I can see some logic in it, but you know, what was so enticing about this business sort of back in 2004?
It's a really good question, and we had a business advisor on board with us, and I set them some criteria of the kind of business I was looking for. One, I had to be able to afford to buy it, that was kind of pretty key. But also, I said I would like to have it an export arm to it, because I've got really good export experience by this point in my career, so it would be great if it had that. And also, it needs to be broadly in engineering of some description. And so, diesel generators, okay, they're certainly not up there in terms of high tech that you'd see at Rolls-Royce PLC or indeed at GC Alstom, but you know, it's engineering, I understand it. And this business was about 50-50 UK and export. So it fitted the bill. And with our advisors, we were able to get financing from the banks. I have to say, in those days, money was flowing easily. So it wasn't a huge challenge to get financing to achieve a management buyout, a leveraged management buyout of the business, to allow the owner to exit and retire.
And how many sort of staff did this company have when you bought it?
I think they must have had about 10 or 11 staff, something like that, yeah.
So this is like 15 years ago, so this is your first business purchase.
Yes.
You've had a recent one, that's a month ago, in fact this month. So talk to me about roughly what you can about that period of time, because I think it's 5 years that you've owned this business.
I was all about growing it, and so...
Why are you all about growing it rather than taking it, you know, as much profit out of it as you could? Because isn't that the way the capitalism always goes, isn't it? It's like the GDP must always be rising, the company must always be growing. It seems like this is the way we're sort of, it's ingrained in us to do so.
It is.
Because I always ask a lot of business coaches and business owners I've had on this podcast, why do you want to grow it? And usually I get exactly the same reaction that you just gave me.
Yeah.
I haven't really thought about it, but that's just the way it is. It's like, you know, why does the moon, why is the moon where it is? This sort of thing, it was because it's there.
Sure.
Sort of answer.
Yeah. My answer is straightforward. I would be bored if I just sat in there and it ticked along. I would simply be bored. That's my answer.
Okay, because you strike me as a man who gets bored quite easily. And that's not a criticism, it's just an observation.
Sure.
And a giggle suggests that other people may have said something similar to you previously. So during this period of non-boredom, of growth, you know, where was it? I mean, did you go from 11 staff to... No, what happened? Did the staff number stay the same?
We grew through we grew organically because there was a big construction boom going on in the UK in particular and in Africa. So because of the UK construction boom, new buildings, new commercial buildings, pretty much all of them need generators, standby generators. So there was a huge buoyant market. And in Africa, which is our major export market, in the Middle East to a smaller extent, there's a big market for generators as well. Particularly in Africa at that time, with the boom in mobile telephony, every single mobile mast needs two generators. And so we were fortunate that we had a strong distribution base in both East and West Africa who would order batches of generators from us at a go. So we're able to grow organically thanks to both of those industrial sectors growing terrifically and tremendously at the time. So there was that, and we also achieved a couple of other acquisitions as well. There was a small acquisition we did, which frankly didn't work out. It brought a few more customers to us, but it didn't achieve the kind of growth we'd hoped. And then there was a larger acquisition we did, which was a similar company to ours, but they were much more focused on the aftermarket rather than the sale of the actual equipment. They were a perfect fit for the business. And that allowed us to grow through all of that I've just described over 5 years. It allowed us to increase the turnover 9 or 10-fold. And we had about 55 people on the team.
That was incredible growth in that period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well done to you. And then obviously all good things come to an end.
Yes, they do. It
takes it to about 2009.
Yeah.
You know, what was your next step? Yeah, I think having probably sold-ish around about this time.
In 2008, we had the financial crash, And that's when the expression of banks giving you an umbrella when the sun is shining and taking it away when it starts raining really hit home, because we'd conducted a leveraged management buyout, which, to put it into plain English, meant we took out a huge loan in order to buy the business.
With personal guarantees.
Yeah, and the bank wanted the money back, and it wanted it back now.
Ouch.
Yes. So, through a very painful process, we were able to refinance the business, but the process was, frankly, so painful that it took the wind out of my sails, and I decided I'd had enough, and I exited.
Fair enough. But no doubt you weren't sort of twiddling your thumbs, you know, in this next period of your life. You know, how did you end up getting to Harrogate? Because Harrogate is not featured thus far. I think Yorkshire has a little bit, but where did Harrogate fit into all this?
Well, the business was based near York, and so I was living in York, and then I met my girlfriend who was living in Harrogate, and so I moved to Harrogate once things became, you know, reasonably serious.
And you're still with Jane to this day, I think.
I am, yes.
But you divide your time, a bit like Richard Branson, who I know that you've met, I'm name dropping on purpose, between, you know, Yorkshire and the British Virgin Islands.
He probably doesn't know he met me, by the way.
He may not know that, but you certainly met him. But you divide your time between Yorkshire and the British Virgin Islands. I mean, how lucky are you? How did you find yourself with a relationship with the British Virgin Islands?
Well, quite simply, having exited, I didn't have anything to do, so I was trying to figure out what to do next. And I knew I wanted to do a bit of leisure time, because I had just worked ridiculous hours, and there had been no play, despite your description of me as a playaholic, during the previous 5 years. And Jane was in a similar situation, that she'd been made redundant and was looking for a job. And she said to me one day, "So look, I've been offered an interview with this company. The interview's in Bristol, but the job's in the British Virgin Islands." That's, well, you know, may as well go to the interview. Fine, of course, whatever. And so she came back and said, "Well, yeah, okay." And a few days later, "Yeah, they want to see me again, and they're serious." And I'm ashamed to admit that we had to pull out the atlas to find out where the British Virgin Islands were. and we're looking at it. So, hang on a sec, it's the Caribbean. That sounds all right. So I've got to be honest, we didn't take it seriously. I said, "Look, I don't think this is for real," and nor did she. And I said, let's smoke them out. I said, "Okay, say to them you'd like to make an inspection visit to the British Virgin Islands to see the office and meet your boss, and that you want your boyfriend to come with you, because obviously he's got to be happy with the whole thing as well."
Makes sense.
Yeah, so I thought, yeah, that's it. We won't hear from them again. And they just came straight back and said, "Book your flights." So, yeah, bluff well and truly called. So off we went, and of course we liked it. Jane got her job, of course. Just because it's the British Virgin Islands, it doesn't give any British person status at all. You have to have status there of some description. And so if you want to work, you have to have a work permit. Otherwise, sling your hook. Simple as that. And so I had to figure out how to normalise my status. And the way I chose was to apply for and luckily receive a trade licence.
Trade licence to do what?
My first trade licence was to conduct digital marketing and software distribution. So that was what the trade license was for. And then I started from scratch building that business, having spent 6 months working out how to do that and doing a lot of sailing in the Caribbean regattas.
Hence the playaholic description, which I think is fair as well. You've underplayed it a little today. But as a sort of, you know, Brit going out to the British Virgin Islands, you know, what was it like the first time you got there? You know, describe it to us. I've been to Cuba, but I think that's very different, I'm assuming, for the BVI.
It is, yeah.
You know, just, you know, paint a picture for me, please.
Well, the scenery would be similar to Cuba, apart from, of course, if you're in Havana and you've got all of those old buildings that seem to be in a time warp, and they're all very beautiful. But of course, that's all Spanish colonial influence. Whereas the BVI, regrettably, a lot of the heritage is gone, because as financial services has increased the wealth of the country, people have been able to build solid buildings, steel reinforced concrete and all of that, which I know we'll get on to talk about this, served them well in 2017. But there's no high rises or anything like that. They're all low rise, and you've still got the old street in Road Town, where you can still see some of the old colonial buildings and things like that. And it's just generally beautiful islands. I'd say the main island of Tortola, which is the biggest, where industry is located mostly. It's a working island mostly. Tourism tends to go to the other islands, and there's 65 other islands, so there's plenty of places for them to go to.
65, I would have guessed, yeah. Two if you were to ask me. Yeah. 65, goodness, or 66, I guess, yeah. It would be.
It seems to be a bit of a moot point. 66 seems to be the common, everyone will go, yeah, well, okay, it's 66, we think.
And the business that you started, this digital marketing business, what was it called? What is it called?
I called it Phoenix Caribbean.
I'll repeat that. Yes. I like it. Does that sound like a film?
I'm slightly embarrassed about it, because it sounds, to me, people who name their business after themselves, it kind of sounds egotistical to me, to be honest. And it was not done for reasons of ego. It was done because I knew my email address would be my first name and then at Phoenix Caribbean. And so every time I emailed my friends in England, it would be an immediate reminder that I now lived in the Caribbean. That was the rationale for doing it. It was basically a two fingers to my friends.
Yeah, childish but funny.
Indeed, until they all, you know, defriended me.
I bet they did. And so talk me through the next stage in your business journey. You've got your ability to trade in the BVI. Mm-hmm. You have your new company named after yourself, and it grows. And you now have companies in Harrogate. Explain the link.
It very quickly became apparent to me that if I was going to have a digital marketing agency, I needed some kind of website development capability. And I could build websites myself. I'm, after all, a software engineer by training. Wasn't something I wanted to do myself, didn't particularly interest me. So, okay, how am I going to get this kind of ability? So I can either recruit, or I can look at maybe finding another business to do that. And fortunately, at that time, I heard about a company where the owner was looking to sell the company and leave the British Virgin Islands. And I didn't contact them because I was concerned that, well, okay, if they're the founder and they're the owner and they leave, they're actually just leaving your holding not very much. But I kept hearing about them. So in the end, I thought, you know what, just ring them up. So I did. And it turned out that, yes, they did want to move to the UK, but they still wanted to remain involved in the business. They would still do that kind of work. And of course, the nature of web development and the internet, how it's progressed these days, means you can, in fact, develop websites sat in your front room, as long if you really feel that way inclined. So that started to make a bit more sense. So I bought out the majority shareholder, who was a silent partner, and we started to grow the business, but not just the website business. It quickly became apparent that they had a small IT arm to the business as well. And so we started to grow that. And it turned out that was really a really fortunate time to decide to do something like that. Because with financial services growing in the country, financial services is about 80% of GDP. All of these small businesses, small as we would see them, are part of global businesses, but they all need local IT support. And because they are parts of global companies, they want professional, first class, I would say, world class support from all of their suppliers. And we were one of the first companies in the BVI to be able to do that from an IT perspective, and that allowed us to really grow.
But tell us how this segues into Yorkshire again.
Sure. Well, as we were able to grow and fortunately be successful, I started to look at how we could grow the team. And it's quite tough to actually recruit in the BVI. It may sound ridiculous to listeners who've been to the Caribbean or see all those beautiful pictures of the Caribbean. It's very different living and working there than it is going on holiday there, just like it is anywhere else for that matter. You have a romanticised view from being on holiday. But we would recruit people sometimes from outside of the country, and they would come in and first couple of months, oh, this is terrific. But then it would dawn to them that they're not on holiday. And that's, you know, you're living in the Caribbean. It's very different to living in the UK or the US or wherever they've come from. And they would leave. So you need a particular mindset to live and work there. And of course, it's a small country, so being able to find local talent is also a challenge. So both of those factors made me look at another acquisition. So I looked at one in the States, and that fell through. I sulked for 24 hours, and then I got up thought, well, let's have a rethink. And I had a look in the UK, where I hadn't looked before, and lo and behold, there was an IT business up for sale in Ripon, 10 miles up the road from Harrogate. So didn't think it was real, thought this can't be possible, and in 2015 I bought CCS 2000.
Very good. And how many people did it have when you purchased CCS 2000?
CCS 2000 had about the same number of people it has today. So, oh no, that's not quite right. I think five people were in CCS and we're at eight today, but yeah.
And therefore you're providing support, I understand it, for businesses with the CCS team in Ripon and also the team in British Virgin Islands.
Sure.
That must be the only connection between Ripon and the British Virgin Islands, I guess, or Harrogate and British Virgin Islands, for that matter. There can't be many sort of two locations where this was in the Caribbean. It's a great story.
Well, thank you. It might be the case, and we're quite gratified when the governor of the British Virgin Islands actually came to celebrate our BVI business, which is called Fresh Mango, its 10th anniversary last year. And one of the first things he said was, you know, this is one of the first examples of a BVI company actually buying a business from the mother country. And he actually said, you're like Tata. I said, yeah, we're not quite on that scale, Governor, but thanks. I appreciate the sentiment.
Tata Steel.
Yes.
I can see the similarities there a little bit.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, without the strikes outside the smelting.
Indeed.
So you buy CCS in 4 years ago, and you know, talk me through these last 4 years up to buying a business. And I think there's an event in 2017 that really requires some in-depth discussion.
There was. I mean, as it turned out, it might sound ridiculous, but we actually had to bring CCS up to the standards of Fresh Mango. You would think that a UK business would be at a higher standard than a Caribbean business.
I would
think that.
Yeah.
But because of the nature of the customers that we have in the British Virgin Islands demanding this first-class, world-class support, it made Fresh Mango, without us realising it, really, really good. And when we took over CCS, we realised we were better than CCS, and so we needed to bring CCS up to standard. You can't do that overnight, but you can do it, and we achieved that. And I'm pleased we did, because 2 years later, on September 6, 2017, a date I'll never forget, Hurricane Irma, the strongest, biggest Atlantic storm in history, went directly over the British Virgin Islands and literally wiped out our business.
As in the premises were destroyed?
Yes. Along with pretty much every other building in the country, not necessarily being wiped out, but I don't think there was a building that did not sustain damage. However, most of them being concrete helped immensely. Not hugely, but immensely. At least just the physical structure was still standing. Most of the roofs went.
Hence the working book title, The Moment of Get Up.
Yes.
So I can't imagine being in a hurricane or even a country that's, you know, hit by repeated hurricanes, but your business is destroyed. How did you get up from there?
I wasn't there when the hurricane hit. And I would, even now, give anything to have been there when the hurricane hit. I could see, I was here. I was at CCS on a business trip.
Did you know it was coming?
Oh yeah, that's the thing about hurricanes. You know they're coming.
I thought so.
But they nearly always go north, as we put it. You're watching the track and you're waiting for some kind of wind shear to take it north of the islands, which usually happens in the British Virgin Islands. This one didn't. It came off Cape Verde and it just kept coming in a straight line and it just kept getting bigger and stronger and bigger and stronger. It hit Barbuda. We couldn't get any news out of Barbuda the next day. So I was in Skype communication with Jane about, you know, PEP and all of that, etc., etc. And then it hit, and it was 3 days before I was able to ascertain if she was alive. And she was. Yeah. So yeah, all was well in the end. But yeah.
How did she survive the hurricane?
The house was really strong. It's a concrete house, and fortunately we had a concrete roof. Most people have tin roofs, you know, the kind of aluminium kind of stuff, and they just went. And the moment the roof went, the house went.
So was she shielding other people in the house?
One of our senior technician was there on a technical visit, so he was in the house with her, and as was our dog.
Were the windows put in?
Oh, well, no. I mean, everything was barricaded off. You have shutters and all of that kind of thing. The back doors did get ripped open at one stage, and they had to spend 35 minutes literally holding them there whilst the tail end of the hurricane went through.
My goodness. So a few days before you know, and then probably an emotional phone call when they were in communication. And then you got on the plane, get back there as soon as you could?
No, it was 4 months before I could go back.
Why is that?
The airport was shut and wiped out. And then the British Armed Forces did a magnificent job of coming in. The Royal Fleet Auxiliary that's always on standby during season had stood off whilst the hurricane went through and then immediately came in. But whilst they've got great resources and great guys, the whole country was flattened. So it really needed the cavalry. So HMS Ocean was on standby in Gibraltar, and so she was basically provisioned with everything that was possible and steamed over and arrived about 10 or 12 days later to really get the recovery underway. And they did a fantastic job, but it was months before the airport reopened. And I'll tell you straight, because of my Rolls-Royce days, I've got a lot of friends who are either military or ex-military. And I rang them all up, begging them to find me a jump seat in a Hercules to get me back onto the island. And they refused, and they quite rightly refused, because A, I'd be taking up a seat of someone who could actually add some value to the recovery, and B, I would have just been another mouth to feed when they didn't have any food to feed people with. So yeah, they were right to just stop my naturally selfish instincts of wanting to go back and help, because you want to go back and help, but they're right, I wouldn't have been able to help.
So Jane and your colleagues then survived on, let's call it, handouts.
Well, I mean, they survived on a massive stock of tinned food that we'd built up in the storeroom. Yeah.
So 4 months later, eventually you're allowed back. And during that 4 months, was the premises closed? No business undertaken?
The building was destroyed, but we were able to move in with, first of all, temporarily we moved in with one of our clients whose building was hurricane proof, and they'd sort of survived. Keep in mind, there's no electricity at this point, therefore there's no internet, there's basically nothing. But we can start to recover. And what I did was I set up CCS as our communication hub for all of our clients. Now, of course, most of our clients had been taken out, but because they are typically global clients with offices in Hong Kong or London, the Channel Islands and so on and so forth, they did the same thing as me. They were taking on the work of their client base. So I was able to communicate with them as well. And I think after about a week, Jane discovered there was one mobile phone mast that was operational in Roadtown, and it was by an establishment called The Pub. Guess what they do? So literally the team would walk, because the roads were smashed up, would walk and convene at the pub at 9 o'clock on a morning, and they would crowd around this mobile phone on speaker, and I would be at this end relaying all of the requirements from our customer base. So, okay, you need to go and see so-and-so, you need to go and see so-and-so, etc., etc., etc. And that's how we started the recovery. Literally on foot, sometimes the technicians would be wading through flood water, going and knocking on doors, finding out, because the client base wanted to know what status their BVI officers were in. And then from that, we could start to help them plan. Now, I'll be honest, there were some dark days. I could not see a way through. I could not see how it would be possible to recover. And then it was only when the general manager of one of our clients, she got evacuated, and she texted me, she was back in the UK, and rang, and so we had a phone call, and she started talking about that they were going to establish a temporary office in Antigua with a view to moving back in 12 months' time, and that they wanted to just repurchase all of the equipment that had been lost through us. And then I suddenly thought, okay, we might be okay.
Because imagine cash flow was beyond difficult at that time, if you're paying wages and your clients aren't paying.
Yeah, I financed everything out of my own savings at that point. Yeah.
My goodness. So when was it that the business was back on even keel, if it ever has.
Sure. Well, I got back 4 months later, which was just before Christmas, and mercifully, electricity was restored at our house a week after that. So Jane had been without electricity for 4 months, and so first thing we had to go and do, it turned out, was buy a new fridge because the fridge had gone kaput, which meant that we could actually buy food to put in a fridge and make a nice Christmas dinner, which we did. And then the first few months of the year, I looked for premises. We established new premises, bigger and better than the ones we'd had. And by that point, the recovery was really going well. All our clients were starting to recover as well. And so by the end of 2018, it was business as usual.
Very good. Well done. Which takes us nicely into how you've recently purchased a business in Leeds. Yet another business to buy.
Sure. Well, clearly the whole hurricane thing set us back. I mean, not in terms of it set us back for obvious reasons, but it was also a setback in my development plans for the company, because I'd always had an eye on wanting to establish a stronger presence in Yorkshire once we knew we'd built CCS to the frankly world-class levels that it operates at. And so I was actively looking for a business and was able to negotiate and agree a retirement sale of a similar size company in Leeds just last week.
Well done. Now, Guy, how many businesses have you bought? Do you know?
I don't. Sorry. Off the top of my head, I don't.
When someone answers a question that they don't know the number, that suggests that the number is high. And the number of offers you would have made over the years is probably even times, whatever it is, times five or whatever. Now, would you have any tips for business people who are looking to buy a business? Is it just do your due diligence, get a lawyer, an accountant, or is it more to it than that? I imagine you've got some tips.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're right about all of the due diligence stuff. The first time you do it, you'll look at the professional advisor fees and you'll take a sharp intake of breath if you don't pass out. They're worth it. They are absolutely worth every penny. Do not even consider skimping on it. Okay, get an advisor for your first deal. Okay.
You mean as a business advisor? Are you talking like lawyer advisor?
No, you'll need a lawyer as well to take you through the deal. But I'm talking about someone who can give you commercial advice as well and walk you through it. Because the most challenging thing is, particularly in a retirement sale, this is the vendor's baby. Okay, they've got pretty much a lot of their life invested in this business. Okay, and making sure they're comfortable and happy with it is probably the most challenging thing. You might say, well, hang on a sec, you know, they're going to get gazillions or X hundreds of thousands out of the deal. You know, what's the problem? It's not about the money. It's a 90% emotional decision for them.
So why would you need a business advisor to deal with what is simply a human question? I don't understand.
Because first time round, you might not recognize that. You might go into it in the rational way that I would have gone into it. It's like, well, you know, I'm bringing a big checkbook. What's your problem, mate? But it's absolutely not like that. So you need someone to guide you and to be the bridge between, you know, they will have their moments where they'll say the deal is off, and they will act as the intermediary and spear legal
conduit.
Word. Yeah, conduit. Thank you. Would be a good word, but someone who mediator. That's the word I'm looking for. They would effectively be the mediator who will, you know, bring the temperature down.
And take a percentage of the deal.
Yes.
Okay, so first bit of advice, you heard it here, ladies and gentlemen, get a business advisor. But anything else that you would give in terms of buying businesses?
For sure. Be sure of your reasons for doing it. Be absolutely clear on your reasons for doing it. Yeah, and boil it down to, you know, well, my reason is X. Why? Okay, then when you give your answer to that, why? Well, why? Just keep asking why until you distill it down to why you actually want to do it. What are the reasons for doing it? And if you can't look yourself in the mirror and give yourself a straight rationale for doing it, then just pause.
Sound advice. And what advice would you give to people setting up or contemplating setting up their first business? You know, should anybody set up a business? Are we all cut out for it? You know, should you give it a go in the corporate world? You know, any sort of pearls of wisdom from your long business career?
Sure. What's the worst that can happen, and what are you waiting for? Seriously, I come across people a lot who are saying, well, you know, I'm in this job and I'm not happy with it, so I'm thinking of setting up on my own and this, that and the other. But of course, I've got all of these commitments. And it's that of course, is the real fear, that how are they going to meet their financial commitments for themselves or their family and that kind of thing. And that's absolutely legitimate, of course. But what is the worst that can happen? You go out and you try it. The worst that can happen is it fails.
And you're bankrupted and you lose the house.
In the worst case, but be careful how you do it. You don't necessarily need to put everything on the line for it. Okay, you don't necessarily need to have to do that if you think about it. If you're starting up on your own, then there's not necessarily that much financing required. So make sure you've got enough savings in the bank to see you through a certain amount of time. And also set yourself a reasonable cutoff date. Year one is just going to be horrible. There's no two ways about it. You won't have experienced anything like it. And you'll every night you'll wake up thinking, why am I doing this? But guess what? There'll be a year two and it'll be a bit better. And then there'll be a year three and that'll be a bit better. And then suddenly you wake up one morning and think, actually, this is all right.
Guy, I'm going to call you out on that, because okay. I have said this point to a number of the business coaches who've been interviewed on the Harrogate podcast, when they give advice not dissimilar to what you just said about setting up, you know, what's the worst that can happen, de-risk yourself, etc. All sounds very plausible to me, but is it not so that 80% of new businesses collapse in the first 5 years? So when you say what's the worst that can happen, you've only got a 20% chance of being around in 5 years' time.
Yes.
So even with those odds stacked against you, just go ahead with it.
No, you're asking me what advice would I give to someone like myself, and it would be just go for it.
Okay, are you wired differently, though? You know, is there an entrepreneurial wiring that you and other people have that sort of sets you apart from others?
I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. Crikey, you've just given me a flashback to my schools, my school days when I was head of the debate team. We did a debate on whether everything is preordained or whether we're all products of our environment. I do think it's the latter. In fact, I think I argued that side of it. You take your chances. Let me put it this way. If it's something you really think you want to do, and in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and you go and do it, and in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, it fails, if the 80% stat is correct, you tried, right? You tried. Would you rather be retirement in 35 years' time, looking back, thinking, what if I should have done that? Is that really what you want to be doing? And then spending those 30, 35 years just going through the motions. So there are people who are very happy with that, and that's great. You know, good, you're happy, and that's ultimately the main thing in life, isn't it? Whereas if you've got this itch to scratch and this what if, don't be that person when you retire who's going to be sat there thinking, what if? Try it.
I would summarize that as don't have a deathbed regret, I guess, in a summary.
I guess, yeah.
Guy, what advice would you give to people who are running businesses over two sites? I mean, not just two sites for you, but two countries, two continents.
Sure. Well, the first thing you need to do is to make sure that your IT and your telecommunications are integrated. So please come talk to me about that. And after that shameless plug, quite seriously, you need to ensure that your processes and your systems are in place to allow you to do that. And so that's, and also the people. It's systems, processes, and people. You could argue that's the same in any business, but it's particularly important when you're managing multi-site and multi-jurisdictional companies. And once you've got those people in place and they're all trained and they understand the processes, etc., and you continue to improve your processes, as you should do in any business, it falls into place, actually. And everyone gets used to it. The most important thing is just getting people used to, I don't like using the phrase, virtual working. So in other words, everyone's got a camera, everyone's got some kind of video conferencing facility, be it Skype or Zoom or Skype for Business, one of those. And just getting used to, instead of going to the office next door to say, oh, can I just have a word? Jumping onto a video conference call saying, oh, can I just have a chat?
Yeah, most people don't do that. I know we don't do that in our office, and I think we're quite good with tech.
Sure. So it's those kind of things. Yeah.
The modern world, indeed, yeah. You are living it. Now to networks. I ask all my businessy contacts about networks because not a day goes by that I'm not invited to one or two networking events in Harrogate. I don't know how there are so many networking events, but now, do you go to any, or what tips do you have to people in Harrogate in relation to networks?
Yeah, I do. On my business trips to the UK, I probably overdose on them because I'm trying to do as much as possible. So I think the expression last week was that I was networked out by Friday night, having done 5 networking events that week.
And which 5 did you do?
Oh, crikey, which 5 did I do? See, I've slept since then.
You must have done a B&I.
I did do a B&I, actually, yes. I did do a B&I. And
a B2B?
I did a B2B.
Network North?
I didn't do a Network North. I did a Profit Club. I think I did an Action Club. And there's one other that escapes me. Oh, it was another B2B at Leeds Bradford Airport. They said they've got one going down there as well.
And why do you overdose out on networks? Networking?
Because I think we have tried so many different marketing approaches for lead generation for the business as part of our organic growth aspirations. And I think it's not an exaggeration to say we've probably tried pretty much every marketing lead generation, every lead generation activity that there is in any marketing book. And the ones that are proving the most successful are through networking and building and coming back to building relationships.
Are very Japanese.
So desu.
And the Japanese, would they have networking groups like this, or would they just way too sophisticated that society is sort of built upon these networks that it would seem preposterous to go to a B&I or a B2B?
It's a good question. I don't know about modern Japan, whether they've come with that, but they do naturally network through the conglomerate business groupings, the keiretsu, and then on a smaller level through their individual teams and the way they work with their client base in the ways I've described previously. And just as an aside, when I was there, we did set up our own little individual networking group called the 1066 Club, and it was comprised of British expats in Japan and Japanese who had been expatriates in Britain. And we used to go to a British restaurant, which might sound like an oxymoron from those days, but there you go, it was called 1066.
The day that Britain was invaded for the last time successfully.
That's right.
How out.
Yeah.
Guy, in your working life, you'd have dealt with lots of banks, either when you were working for PLCs or when acquiring businesses, selling businesses, and just for ordinary banking. My sense is that you have some tips for business people dealing with banks, and please be nice.
Okay. Obviously, I had an experience with the first business that I owned when the financial crash hit that has and will stay with me for the rest of my life in the way that the bank dealt with us. And I don't think I was alone in that experience. In fact, I saw a presentation at one of the networking events last week where one guy stood up and was very open about his experience, in which was not dissimilar to mine. He wasn't as nice about them in his talk as I'm going to be in this discussion. Look, they perform a valuable function, particularly if you are in a startup position and you do need finance. Go into it with your eyes open, though. Do not sign guarantees which you're uncomfortable with, and that, keeping in mind the statistic that Andrew just gave you about the 80% failure rate, think about that. If you do fail, how much are you in fact prepared to lose? Because be in no doubt, if you've guaranteed it, the bank will take it, okay? Because they're in business as well. And so looking at it as a defender of the bank, which I'm not, they're in business, so they have to make money as well, and that's why they put those guarantees in place. So do it carefully, do it with your eyes open. Regrettably, these days, it's much more difficult to form a relationship with a bank because of the way they've structured themselves. And whilst I know they have relationship managers, in my experience, typically, they will only deal with bigger businesses, because that's what they're going after. So if you're a small business, trying to get a relationship is a real challenge, and to get someone to understand your business is a challenge. So just keep that in mind when you're doing it. But ultimately, do whatever you can to get yourself to a point where you're no longer dependent on the bank as soon as humanly possible. And from that point forward, don't take any more and take on any more debt, unless there's a really good opportunity and a genuine reason for doing it. For example, an acquisition that's a perfect strategic fit for you.
I think that's sound advice. Yeah, in a way, avoid banks as much as you can, other than for ordinary banking sort of functions. Very brave. But Guy, as I come to the end of the podcast, you know, what's next for you? You've got, you know, some of 60 years of probably acquiring businesses and so on. You know, are we going to see you on the Dragon's Den type thing? Are we going to see you at Necker Island with Richard Branson, which you haven't told us about?
Yeah. I've never been to Necker Island.
Oh,
actually.
Sorry.
I think I met Sir Richard on his yacht in at Wanna Marinas many years ago. He kindly opened up the yacht for people to come and have a nose around Necker Bell, and so that was quite nice. So, what's next? I've got to do some work to integrate the new business, which is going to be great.
That's IDT.
IDT, that's right, in Leeds. So looking forward to that. Delighted to say that all of the staff have embraced the new ownership. They're really excited, and so I am as well. That's short term. I also am considering doing more with Phoenix Caribbean over here, rather than in the Caribbean as well. I'm also about to launch a software as a service, which we're very close to launching. I'd hoped to do it last week, but just when the front end website was presented to me a couple of days ago, there's a few things that we just need to improve upon it. So that will be launched within the next few weeks, and then we'll see where that takes us.
You just say that flippantly. So SaaS, is it called? Is it software as a service?
That's right. Yes.
So what is the service?
Well, about 5 or 6 years ago at Fresh Mango, as we started to grow, one of the first things you need in any IT business, if you're supporting customers, is some system of recording the support requests that's better than Excel. And it needs to be a lot better than Excel. So we thought, okay, well, we need to get some software that's going to allow us to record tickets. And we really couldn't find anything that we liked. There's plenty of commercial off-the-shelf software available, but we would need to compromise the way we operate the business in order to fit in with the software. We didn't like that. So guess what? We've got a bunch of clever guys who can write software, so let's write our own. So we did. And we started to use it, and we started to enhance it and improve it and all of that, and get it operating as we needed it to operate. And so we then started to increase its capability to the point that it's become a complete business management system. It's not just a ticketing system. It goes from everything from initial lead right the way through to you've won whatever it is, you've won the project. It can now then have a bunch of support tickets or projects for a particular customer. And then we've gone even further, and it can now integrate with the major accounting packages. So this holy grail that people are always looking for, where you've got customer records in your CRM system, you've got customer records in your accounting system, you've got customer records here, there and everywhere. Typically, businesses will have 3 or 4 different systems with the customer records. We've got a one-stop shop, and we implemented it at CCS very successfully. And again, it's continued to develop. So we've basically had a 6-year development cycle on this software. And we know it's as bug-free as software can be. I mean, to beta testing, it doesn't even begin to describe it. And thinking about it last year, and I think I was at a seminar or maybe reading a book where they talk about, if possible, sell a product that your competitors would buy. And it was one of those blinding flashes of the obvious moments. The light bulb went off. I thought, you know what? Let's sell our IT support system. So that's going to be the software as a service that we will launch, and we will market it to UK IT businesses and US IT businesses to begin with, and see where we go.
And there'll be an IPO, and hopefully I get an invite to Phoenix Island. There's another 65 that could be purchased. Well, you know where I am for the invites. Guy, it's been, again, a real pleasure interviewing you. Thank you for your time. and I wish you the best of luck with the new business and the book and the movie when that actually comes out. And if anybody's got the CCTV footage of the Japanese bar of some Englishman smashing his head during a rendition of Hound Dog, well, you can contact me and I'm delighted to share it. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.